Hello, and welcome to episode 30 of React Native Radio. Today on our panel, we have Kevin Old.
Hey, everyone.
Peter Pykarczyk.
Hey, everyone.
Lee Johnson.
What's up?
And I'm your host, Nader Dabit. Today, we're going to be talking about consulting, freelancing, side projects, pretty much anything that you do either away from work or if you're a full-time freelancer as your work. So me personally, I've kind of been doing some freelancing stuff on and off for about 7 or 8 years now. It's just depending on if I have a full-time job or not. Whether or not I'm taking clients really depends on kind of what's going on at the moment in my life. So I guess like right now I have a full-time job and I have had full-time jobs for the past, 3 or 4 years. But I've also run my own consulting company for about a year. So I guess I can kind of discuss this from a few different angles. I know, Peter, you've been doing some consulting lately, haven't you?
Yeah. So I left Trunk Club about in early February to consult full time, primarily just to keep myself afloat while I'm working on my own project. It's definitely been an interesting experience. And I've learned a lot about myself in terms of, you know, like, I don't know if you can consider it starting a company, but technically you are. There's a lot of those fine details and things that you pick up along the way that protect you from things that could go wrong, right? Some interesting facts, and I may be jumping a little ahead here, is for some of your larger projects, consider creating a LLC for that particular project. So if things don't work out, and for some reason that client wants to sue you, they can only sue you for the cost of the project and you protect your other assets. I know it doesn't really make sense if you're working on a $2,000 to $5,000 project, you know, especially like in Illinois, an LLC costs $600. But if you're working on, if you're at the point where you pick up like a $20,000 or $30,000 project, it sort of makes sense to do something like that to protect yourself. Yeah. Anyone else have any cool tips and tricks that they've used along the way?
Well, I can say from experience too, like, yeah, well, as far as the getting the LLC is concerned, it's pretty inexpensive here in Mississippi. It's like $50, I think. And it's something you can kind of do online. So, yeah, I would also recommend doing that if you have some larger clients or if you're considering continuing doing that type of business. I guess to start the conversation off, getting clients, I guess, is always something to think about, or that's always something to be worried about. Not so much if you're like a part-time consultant, a part-time freelancer, and you have a full-time job, because it's not really your primary source of income. But I guess a few things I can kind of say about getting clients that I've learned over the past few years is networking, and having like a strong network has been key. And in my experience, I've started a meetup group about 2 years ago. Through that meetup, I've had a very big increase in potential clients that have come to me, so much so now that I'm not even taking any clients for months. So if you're looking to get into freelancing or consulting, or if you are doing that, I would suggest maybe getting involved with a meetup group or even starting your own meetup group on something that's not already around, because even if you have to pay the meetup cost out of your own pocket, $50, $100 a month or something like that, you'll see a lot more money than that coming in. You can also have more options to choose from. So instead of just waiting for any project to come in and then forcing yourself into a project that might not be a good fit, you'll be able to kind of look at a dozen or so projects and kind of pick the one that you want. And then you also have the option of kind of subcontracting work. If you have someone that you know is really efficient looking for work, you can kind of, you know, resell the project or that type of stuff. But that's a whole different conversation, I guess. It would be kind of product or project management as opposed to being an on-hand freelancer or consultant. What about you guys? Any experience about getting or keeping clients?
I think in terms of getting clients, putting yourself out there makes a big difference. I've had numerous people like reach out to me on Twitter and just through like email, just because they saw one of my talks or, you know, saw something I tweeted or just like saw some like random GitHub contribution. I can only imagine what like the core React Native contributors are getting hit up about, just because that's where a lot of people go, you know, especially if you're having issues with a module or whatever. And sometimes you'll find people freaking out like on your issues. Their company will potentially pay for you to come in and fix it. And a lot of that just starts with the open source.
That's a good point. Definitely haven't thought about the open source part of that, but I guess that does make a lot of sense. But as far as talks, blogging, and all that type of stuff, anything you can kind of get involved with to get your name out there, yeah, that's definitely good advice. I know I've had quite a few people that have found me on Medium and have contacted me through Medium, but I haven't given a whole lot of talks, but I assume that would be also definitely a good source of leads and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'd say my most solid leads would be, like you said, from just building a local network. And that can be a good and a bad thing, because you may not want the project that the person, wants to throw your way. And that can be a good thing and a bad thing. You know, someone wants to refer something to you because they know you and, you know, you're their web guy, and you may not want that. So there may be, you may just have to say, well, I'm really not interested in it, or I'm not qualified for that, or it just isn't of interest to me. So, but the network for me has been, a big thing. Even starting out, when I started programming, I was a teenager and I wanted to learn and build. I didn't really want to make money. I wanted to learn and build. So in order to learn and build, at that time I needed a server. So I, started a business hosting websites at $10 a month because I needed 10 customers in order to pay for a single server for 1 month. Servers were $100 in like the late 90s, mid to late 90s, so about 97 or so, 97, 98, and 1998. I'm talking about the year, not the price. And from then, I ended up getting taken. Some situations I got taken advantage of because someone wanted to use me. You know, you kind of go through those learning curves where they're like, hey, well, we'll give you equity. And then you're like, okay, I got burned because this thing didn't turn out to be anything. And those are like real newbie, you know, things, but I guess worth mentioning. And then later on, you find that you're able to kind of discern which projects you should go with and who you should work with. And if they have a realistic timeline, if they have a realistic budget through your network, you can trust your, you know, I have several people that if they referred something to me, I would trust it and, you know, take it. So I also have worked with some people that did what Peter was talking about, and having a piece of open source that a company would pay them to maintain. I worked with a gentleman that had a CPAN module from the Perl days that would work with Apache. So it was Perl and it was C. And so he was basically maintaining that for, it may not have been just one company, it may have been a number of companies, but he was making a substantial amount just maintaining that one module because they saw significance in it, but they didn't know how to work with that specifically. And it was easier to pay him who had the expertise in that to do that. So I've seen both routes, but personally, my network has been where I've been able to, either pick up a project or someone's come to me with something and I've been able to validate it that way through my network. So I think there's a huge, huge thing to say about just your personal network.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as the equity thing, I can totally vouch for that because I've done the same thing where you're like, oh, this is a great idea. Yeah. And they promise the world and you're like extremely optimistic about the project. But it really only takes one time for that to happen before you kind of like learn your lesson. And I've gotten to the point where I really try to not be personally attached to any project. I kind of treat it like it's an important job and I want to make the client happy and I'm going to do the work as to the best, you know, possible way that I can. And I'm going to charge them for that. And that's the only way that it's going to work. There's no equity involved. It just works out better that way. At least in my experience. Now, if you have someone that wants to hire you as a technical co-founder and, you know, they have maybe a real background in a very specialized field and they have a lot of money and maybe a investor or something like that. I mean, that there's always a gray area there, but I would say overwhelmingly the best way to go about it is just billing for work and getting paid and trying to deliver the best possible product that you can.
I would say I agree with that. Just, I haven't done much freelancing just because, and I'll follow that up with my question to you guys, but what little freelancing I have done kind of fell in those same categories. I did several for equity share that never happened. Sometimes the projects never went anywhere. And I did a few for just flat out pay up front. And as a developer, especially somebody doing this as, you know, giving up your free time, I definitely agree that the equity thing is something you really need to look into before you ever consider it. It's usually better not to take it. There may be cases where that isn't the case, but it's the exception, not the rule. But the question I have for you guys is, how do you maintain or balance the number of projects or which types of projects you take on? Because if you're working full time, you know, you've got to sleep and eat. And if you have family, I mean, you have things, other responsibilities. So you have to balance that out. And if you're working as a full time freelancer, you still have to pick and choose your projects. So how do you manage your workload, I guess, and pick your projects?
I think that's the toughest part. Because I don't know if I'm the only one, but you want to take on everything. You kind of almost want to like prove to yourself or prove to this individual, you know, like I can do it, I can make it happen. But I think you kind of you can put yourself down a very scary rabbit hole if you do that. And it turns out, you know, like, hey, this is actually a bit over my head, right? So I tried to, and like the other side of that is if someone comes to you with a project, it's hard to say no, because I think there's like this unwritten rule or thought, like if you say no the first time, like they probably won't come back to you later on. Has anyone else felt that way? Or, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that the two hardest things for me, or the two biggest lessons that I've learned, are billing correctly and trying to figure out the scoping and billing and all of that up front before the project starts. And then number two is figuring out the best way to manage my time and not take too many projects to where it gets out of hand, but also take enough to keep the income level that I'm kind of looking for, you know, in the range where I want it to be. And I guess the best thing that I would say for people that have full-time jobs that are doing consulting is to kind of treat their consulting as a job and set aside hours every week and every month that you sell those hours, and you dedicate a certain time of your day and of your weekend or whatever time that you can fit in your schedule, whether it be in the morning or at night, to those jobs, and never kind of go over that, because then you start getting stressed out and things start to get backed up, and then you get even more stressed out and it just becomes like this terrible thing. So for me, I kind of stay within the range of 20 to 100 hours. And I know that's a big range, but it really depends on my personal life for that month. So if I have like a conference or something I'm going to, or if I'm going on a trip, I'll sell less hours. And if I have nothing going on, I'll probably try to hit the 60 hour mark. And then if there's a really big push to kind of close a project out, I may push that up to 80 or 100. But I think for me, 40 to 60 is kind of a good number to keep as far as keeping a full-time job.
Yeah, I agree with making sure that you limit and you really think about your time as being billable and available in chunks. I try to limit to one project that I have going on, you know, outside of work, because you work a, you know, 40 or 50 hours throughout the week and family. And then I think about the time, you know, so right now I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-month-old. And so 5-month-old is in bed at 8 o'clock. So after 8 o'clock, 8:30, if there's issues going to bed, then after 8:30, I've got maybe 2 hours before I'm going to be tired. I'm really going to be tired. And so I'm not really a morning person. So I've got 2 hours at the end of each day, and I can either watch TV. I can, you know, sometimes it's different every day. It's different every week, But you have to think about, okay, well, can I commit to, you know, what kind of timeline can I commit to? What are their expectations? Like, that's the big thing with me when I approach the one project that I have. And I've gone off and on to where I just didn't do anything for a year because I just wanted to, like, whenever I got free time, I just wanted to play with stuff. And I used a lot of side projects, and I still do. We'll use those to play with something new or just, I don't know, reiterate stuff that I had done in the past but hadn't worked with in a while. I did a lot of data manipulation with Perl way back in the day. And sometimes it's just fun just to manipulate data and get it from one system to another. So I've had various, you know, side projects where they're like, okay, we need to get this data all the way through these stages. And so I would take on some of that just for the, I don't know, the joy. But for me, I have to, if I want an extracurricular, you know, project, it's not really about the money, although I want to be compensated well for it. It's more about if I have interest in it and if I'm going to get something of value out of it, as in professional growth. So that piece will keep the interest there. So it's those nights when it's like 9 o'clock and it's like, oh man, well, I'm tired. You know, if I've got a real interest in the product, the project, the technology, right, I'm going to be more in line to not dismiss that and just say, oh, okay, I'll do it tomorrow, and then get backed up as far as deliverables, which I've done in the past. I've had that to where I've kind of ignored it and said, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, and like really procrastinated on it. And then, you know, the client wants an update or they want to see a working thing, and, you know, I've got to, you know, pull an all-nighter to get things to where they want it. And then I'm not really benefiting, you know, the next day at work and all that kind of stuff. So I think you just really have to look at each of those things. What, you know, your time is valuable, and, you know, pick something that interests you. I've found that if I find something that interests me, I'm more likely to stay with it than and deliver things on time. And the last thing I'll say, and this, we may get back to this when we're talking about like compensation, but I, you know, there's this battle of, do you bill hourly or do you bill per project? A lot of things, it's like, well, the scope of whatever it is you want to deliver is too big. And then if you break it down into chunks and you bill it hourly, based on what you would make at a full-time company, you know, you're asking like $25,000 or something, you know, it's something ridiculous to where they're not going to pay it, you know, if you did it hourly. But if you just say, okay, well, I'll do just a chunk, and you may have a few more hours in one piece of it, but you may make it up in another piece. So I don't know. A lot of those things are real. It's just hard to know that stuff up front. But those are the two options I usually go with, is, you know, I'm either going to bill it hourly or a piece of it hourly, or, you know, just bill it a lump sum. So
I think one of the most important things folks have to realize too when consulting is you're running your own business, which when you work for someone, when you work at, you know, like a engineering company, you're kind of shielded away from all of that. The only thing you have to worry about when you come into work is, you know, what meetings you may have for the day or which component you need to finish, or, you know, like whatever interesting challenge that you may be facing. But when you're consulting, not only are you the engineer, you're also the CEO. Your own CTO, you're your own, you know, VP of marketing, right? You have to handle all of that on your own. And it's one of the reasons too, where I don't recommend you should consult if you're only a few years out of school, just because sometimes, like for me, it has been overwhelming at times, and I'm just like, what am I doing? You know, but I also think that's part of the process too. You kind of learn a lot about yourself through the process, and whether or not like you're the type of person that should be consulting in the first place, right? But you don't realize how many things, at least in my case, I've been shielded from working at a job versus kind of going off on my own now.
So, Peter, how do you normally do your billing? Do you do hourly, or do you do a fixed bid, or do you do it chunks of time, or like, you know, kind of how does that go for you so far, at least?
I tend to stay away from fixed bids just because you could you can definitely shoot yourself in the foot and end up working on something for, you know, much longer than you expected. And then what happens? You get resentful, the quality of work goes down, and chances are the contract doesn't end, you know, on a positive note. So some people might push for a fixed cost, but at that point, I'm kind of just like, okay, this isn't happening. And I only do it if I really need to. Some larger consultancies, what they'll do is that your first project will be a fixed cost in order to gauge your skill level and figure out if it's the right fit for you, right? And you'll quickly learn if it is or not. If you set up your own hourly rate and then you kind of start going overboard with the amount of hours that you're putting in, your hourly rate goes down. And then you kind of have to rethink, like, is this really for me? You know, is it the project that I didn't bill correctly, right? Did I underestimate the amount of work it was going to be? Or it's just a little over my head, right? Is this actually, you know, do I actually know what I'm getting myself into here? I would recommend to everyone just bill hourly. You know, if you're getting started with consulting, even if that means taking a lower rate, but sticking strong to, you know, that rate, do that instead of hourly, or do that instead of a fixed cost.
Yeah, I've had the same experience with fixed bids, and that being the experience was not a good one. I'm sorry, Kevin, were you about to say something?
I did want to jump in on the fixed bid versus hourly rate. And it was more just a tip that came to mind with the hourly rate. And if you're dealing with a client that's serious or not. So throughout my career, I've had various people come up to me and want, quote unquote, a website. And these days it's, I want an app. And it's like, okay, you actually need a website, you know? And before it was, you don't need a website. You just need to be in the yellow pages, or, you know, like I had this like predefined responses because they really were low scale. And whenever, you know, it came to like, well, how much does that cost? Like, you know, how much would it take to build it? Like, they wanted me to say something like $150. And I wanted to say something like $1,500, you know? And the thing is that the point I was going to make was that, like, you can use your hourly rate as a differentiator to help you with serious projects and with people that are serious, not only about the project, but about the money. So if you hit them with that your hourly rate is $65 an hour and they don't have an issue, then you know you're likely on the right track, that these people have dealt with, you know, a contractor or a consultant before, and that you're going to have a better experience. You're going to be able to communicate with them. They already know that stuff that you don't have to teach them. Whereas if someone's like, can you do it for $20 an hour? You may not be talking to someone that has been through, or that's able to provide you with the experience you need as a someone building software. You know, you may have to spend a lot more time helping them understand what they want instead of implementing. So that may affect your rate. So that's really the point I was going to make about that. I do see where the time does get eat up, you know, to your point, Peter and Natter, if you give like a fixed bid. What I typically do is try to highball it, build in some extra cushion on that to where it's not it. If I ate a few more hours, or I guess I should put some actual numbers to this. So what I'm talking about is like, so say someone wants to deploy a site. So I did a site on Shopify. I used that platform to host it. So I didn't have to be the provider, didn't have to build the shopping cart. I just needed to implement, but they had a product catalog of several hundred items. Those were photographs. They had data that needed to be manipulated. They had a lot of moving pieces. This wasn't just put up marketing pages. This was massage a lot of data, get that in there. And I knew I could do the data massaging really quickly. And I knew the other pieces were really trivial to get working. I would need to work with their payment processor and make sure that that got wired in correctly, which it ended up taking several weeks to get that. But it was more of like, I would check in, you know, once a day with the payment processor and figure out, you know, give them some piece, help them understand what Shopify needed from them, or vice versa. And so those weren't like full on coding hours. Those were kind of built in hours that I had for just managing the projects. And to your point, Peter, you're like, you are the CEO, you are the project manager. You know, you can't really think of how many hours am I going to spend at the keyboard. You have to kind of build in the others. So that's generally when I'm talking about like a lump sum or fixed bid, that's where I'm coming from with that, is that some of those hours may not be like super difficult. That's a small percentage, by the way. But yeah, so those are the points I wanted to make.
And it's worth remembering too that you're taxed for everything, right? So when you're $20 an hour, you're not taking home $20 an hour. You're taking home 35, anywhere between 25 and 45% deducted from that $20 an hour, right? So it could be 12 and it could be 15, right? That's something to keep in mind too. And then you have to wonder, like, is it worth it, right? So you have a full-time job and you want to start consulting. So you consult for $30 an hour, where you spend your nights and weekends on a particular project. And let's say something does come up. So the way I think about it and where I'm going with this is I want to charge high enough that it will justify anything else I may be working on, right, on a night or weekend. And that could be, you know, that could be like going out with your friends or hanging out with the family or working on your own project, right? Does your hourly rate justify what you'd be doing otherwise? So,
yeah, absolutely. I've found actually, and this is something that's hard to kind of grasp when you're first starting out, but the more that you charge, the better the experience usually is for both yourself and your client. I've noticed that the higher my rates have gone, the better the work has come out from the project, but also the better communication that I've had with the client and the more respect that I've gotten from the client, and overall just a better experience. And also I've been able to kind of weed out bad clients in the first place. So like, just like you were saying, Kevin, with the people that don't really kind of know what they're looking for, they're not really looking for what they think they're looking for. You don't really have to spend your time kind of, you know, building something that not only is not really what they need, but it's not something that you want to be doing in the first place. So, yeah, absolutely. Like, as far as the taxes is also, like you were saying, you kind of have to factor in all that stuff. And I've had lately some good experience instead of doing the hourly thing, but maybe selling blocks of hours as a retainer. And I do about 50-50 now, but it really depends on the project. I usually only take like one project at a time right now, but depending on what the project is and whether or not I'm able to scope it and give them a good estimate, if it's going to be like a long-term project that I'm kind of either maintaining or kind of going to be working on something for a long time, sometimes it works out really good just to say, hey, you know, I will block off 40 hours a month to work on this project. And, you know, you can buy those 40 hours and you can put me on a kind of like a retainer and I can be available to do any type of work for those 40 hours, whether it be for this or maybe for something else, or maybe you just want to call me and talk to me and get some advice about something. And then you can bill that way. And you know that money's coming in, and it's a lot easier on everyone, I think, to have an agreement like that.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, one thing I want to reiterate is you hit on the word that I was trying to spit out, but the communication is far superior when you have a bit higher rate. When you're able, like, if you hit them with a high rate, and then also another tactic is to, and this isn't really a tactic, it's just basic negotiating, right? You hit with a higher rate than you really want to take home. And so if they ask what your rate is and you give them the rate and then they're like, okay, here's the, you know, let's just do it. Then you know, you're going to have a great experience most of the time. Like I would say that 99% of the time I had a great experience when that happened. And then I had, in the other case, I had a little room to wiggle as far as with that. But the main thing I just want to, you hit dead on it with communication. It's all about the communication. And when you're in that spot where you want, you know, you're a freelancer and you're hired to like pull the lever, you know, it's like, you know, do this one thing, you know, build this. You don't really need to, and I don't know, you may want to, but I really didn't want to help them figure out what they wanted. I wanted to kind of build, because that was something that could be done asynchronously, right? I didn't have to be in their meeting at 9 a.m. when I should be, you know, when I am at work, you know, like I would have to say, no, can we do it at, you know, 5 o'clock or 8 p.m. or, you know, could we do an early one, right? Those didn't work. And so those kind of clients, right, they want you to help them figure it out. If that's what you want, if you want to help build the product, you may want to do that retainer thing, or I don't know, even part-time, you know, contracting. That's kind of where it bridges the gap into, like, should you freelance, or are you a, you know, an actual contractor for them? So, and I don't know if we wanted to take it into that contracting realm, but, you know, that's just that other option there. So,
and that, to add to that too, like, if you're not getting the rate that you want, keep in mind that you're a developer, right? Like, there's going to be another gig that comes up. I've made that mistake in the past of just like taking a project just to take it, you know, and then, you know, they work out, but most of the time, like, one party isn't happy, and that's usually, you know, you as the engineer. So don't ever feel pressured into taking a gig or doing something that you don't want to do, because chances are, if you're feeling that way from the start, it's not really going to work out in your favor later on.
Another thing I'd like to hit on is, like, deliverables, and timelines and realistic expectations. I've had, projects where it's been okay. It's been understood that it's like a long lived project. So that site that shopping cart retail website that I was a part of, I still am on retainer, but I haven't touched that project in over 6 or 8 months, somewhere in there. And the implementation was understood. This guy's a friend of mine, and he understood that it was going to take, a few months of time to complete. And they actually sell baseball bats. And so their season, their off season, you know, is during the winter. So that's when we started the project. So I had until, the spring training starts back up to get things where they wanted it. And you have to understand what their time frame is, and then what your time frame is before you go about committing. I've had when I did some of the data manipulation stuff, that was stuff that I wouldn't do today, because some of those things would be like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they'd send me an email, and I just happened to check my email at that time and say, hey, could you manipulate this tonight? You know, could you get us this script? Cause we need to use it tomorrow. And like, I was able to pick up some quick stuff. Like if I didn't see that email, you know, and I'd gone out, you know, for dinner and had plans that evening, I might not have been able to take that on. So those are two extremes, but you know, I'm just, timeline's a big thing and expectations are a big thing to know up front.
Yeah, I would say that they're very hard to kind of pin down as well, because a lot of times, well, I guess it really depends on if you're a full-time freelancer or if you're a part-time freelancer. If you're a full-time, I guess, you know, not working at a full-time job, but doing that full-time. Because if you are doing that full-time, you can kind of dedicate all of your time to the project and you can deliver a lot faster. Whereas most of the projects I work on are going to take longer because I'm only spending a small amount of time every month on their project. So it's kind of like before we even get to the point of the scope and all of that, once we kind of just get a baseline of what the project's going to be about, I kind of try to make sure that they understand the number of hours that I do have available, which is, you know, limited. And I would say that would be a good thing to keep in mind if you're kind of going to be doing this on the side or whatever. And as far as the setting the scope of the project, you know, it really depends on if you're doing hourly or if you're doing fixed bid, because you do want to have all of the items maybe in the software requirements document or some type of document, so you can kind of at least give a ballpark of how long it's going to take. But a lot of times, once you get into the build and you start demoing things, you realize that they've left out a bunch of stuff. And you know, when you're working with someone that's been doing software for a long time, that will happen less often. But if you're dealing with your typical client, which I would say about 50% of my clients have been people that have local businesses that need an app or something like that. And we don't really get all of those details pinned down to the point where they should be. So it's a good idea to work extra time into your proposal or into your timeline. I usually double the amount of time. I really try to think about how long it's going to take. And I literally try to double that. And I have not had any bad experience with that, because if I try to sell the project to them with an unrealistic timeline, I just don't want to have that stress. And also I know that things are going to come up, and it's worked out really good to kind of give a extra large buffer there. So
I'd agree with nailing down those requirements and expectations in writing. Absolutely. I unfortunately have worked on more projects that had those loose requirements, and most of the side work I've done hasn't been a contract associated with it. But anything I take on new, I do have an agreement. And actually, I was fortunate to work with a guy and to do consulting for him. He farmed out some work to me a few years ago. And it was during a month when I've only freelanced recently, or in the past, I guess, 15 years or so, for a month solid straight, like as an actual freelancer. And he had a contract he sent to me, and it had very detailed stuff. And I thought, oh man, this is fantastic. And we're friends. And I said, man, this is great. Where did you get this? Cause I thought it was one of those legal things. And, you know, I could go and pay $75 and get it. And, it turned out that he had a lawyer draw it up, and, he said, hey, well, just, you can use it. It's good. So I have that as like my, contract. Like, it reads very legally, and you know, definitely do that. And that way you can, because the worst thing is that when you demo something and then they're like, well, what about this? And you're like, well, we never talked about that. And they're like, no, we did. You remember? And it was, I don't know, like you got to have things in writing, because I don't know. The only thing I can think about is like in day-to-day corporate world with Jiras and Trello boards, like you have the card to refer to of what to build. You know, you get that from your project manager or other business person, and that's what they want, right? You've got a mock-up, maybe you've got some loose requirements, you're able to build it and then match it against. And if you go at these freelance consulting gigs and don't have even something minor in documentation, then it's not going to be as fun as it would be as if you did. So I would search for a real good template, or go to one of the legal sites and get one, you know, a loose contract drawn up. And the other thing that I wanted to mention about, you know, you guys were talking about forming an LLC per project, and I've never done that. I've thought about that, but I've just been 1099, and everything that I've done has been on a Schedule C. So, but I've not done anything of any significance as far as that I really thought I needed protection. I don't know, that may have just been being naive.
So. What about payment? What have you guys kind of experienced as far as payment? Like, do you guys charge up front, or do you kind of charge at the end of the month, or is it, you know, how has that been for you guys?
I think a great place with that is get paid.
Yes.
You'd be surprised how hard it is sometimes, right? And mm-hmm. I've had a good experience lately. I don't have much to complain about, really. But getting paid is probably the hardest part about consulting. Mm-hmm. You have to stay on top of it. If you put together a contract and say 50% down, 50% at finish, expect 50% down before you start, and don't do anything until that person pays you. Because you could be finished with the project, they have a product launched or whatever, and you're still shit out of luck with, you know, no money in your pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a lot of luck lately getting a big chunk up front, usually 25% of whatever I feel like we're going to be spending across the entire project. If it's going to be a monthly or an hourly rate, I try to get the first month up front and then start billing ahead of the coming months. And that's worked out really well. And most of the time, any serious customer is going to be okay with that. Sometimes if you're dealing with someone new, they may want to kind of make sure that you're, you know what you're doing. So maybe you can kind of take half up front for whatever you normally would have liked to take the 100% up front if you think it's going to be a good client. But in reality, even that, I really haven't had to do that often. Most of the time, you know, if you're going to be billing monthly anyway, they're going to see your work. And, you know, after a month, if they're not happy with what you're doing, they can just cancel anyway. Yeah, I would recommend definitely not letting things go as far as billing, because if people can take advantage of you, a lot of times they will. So just try to get paid. Like Peter said, just get paid.
Yeah, I would add the third voice to that. Just make sure you get paid, because you really do have to chase people for money. And you would be surprised at how little money you have to chase people for. When I was, I mentioned that I started a hosting business when I was a teenager, and I needed to pay for that server. And so I literally was chasing people down. This was before really the days of like super automation. And so I didn't have a way that my payment processor was AuthorizedNet, and I didn't have a way that I could automate the payments. So I had to like stay on top of it and like bill that. It was $10 a month, $10. And you would be surprised at how I had to chase that down, because a lot of this stuff too, if you're not delivering, if you're doing a service, say you're, I'm trying to think of something that would be comparable to hosting these days. I mean, maybe it is hosting. Maybe you roll that in, that you're going to host the project. That's also another thing that we could chat about. Like, I'm interested what you guys do if you build a web or a React Native app or just an app in general, and how do you hand that stuff off? But maybe I'll ask that in a minute. You have to like build that in to your price, like if you're going to offer that as part of it. And then you got to stay on top of, okay, well, it may take 30 days to turn around. You know, can I do that? I've had that month that I consulted, I was very on top of sending the time, the time tracking as soon as, you know, I had it, and checking code in, you know, those were the requirements for that particular thing. I was, you know, a contractor for them, but I was freelancing. And so I had to fill out timesheet, and then I had to, you know, send code up. I didn't really have to. I wanted that to be up there so that there wasn't any question about the hours, so that they could. And I worked out arrangement to where I would get a weekly, whatever hours I turned in the following week, I would get a check. So I think the main thing I want to say, you know, stay on top of it. And then you can also negotiate your terms. A lot of companies, if you do work with them, they'll say 30 days. But, you know, I've had a consulting thing that came up out of the blue from a friend a few years ago that needed some consulting with something that I had no idea what it was. Or like, I really didn't know the internals. Like, it was Salesforce. They wanted me to help them with their Salesforce integration. And when I got to looking into it, it was like super trivial, like what they wanted. And we had a call, and I'm like, do you realize that you guys could do this? And they're like, I don't think we can. And so, and like, it was kind of one of those things where I didn't have to stay on top of them. They were like, can we just send you money? Right. I mean, literally on those that you have one extreme, you have the other extreme. So yeah, just, you know, stay up to date on it. Know what your terms are. Like, and if I had continued on that with that client that wanted me to do the Salesforce thing, they were willing to do a big retainer, just so that they could call me and, you know, have me available. But then you got to make sure your terms are right. They wanted to call me during the business day, and that wasn't going to be acceptable because I had a full-time job. So I don't know, like the payment thing is, it's interesting. So anyway, guys, what do you do with your projects? Like, so say you Natter and Peter and Lee, you know, you've developed an app. It has some kind of back end that's got some service that needs additional third-party billing, right? So you've got Firebase, you've got, you know, you still have Parse that's hooked up, and you need to migrate them off. Are they paying for it? Are you paying for it? How do you go about talking through the client, or talking them through that that piece?
Well, for me, I have a few spreadsheets that I keep for each. I keep one spreadsheet for each project, with any services that I'm that we're using. And then I also keep a separate spreadsheet per project, kind of consolidated for any for anything that I'm maintaining. And I would say, for the most part, when I'm done with a project, they don't want to handle any of that themselves. So I normally just add up whatever it costs per month, and I mark it up, and I just bill them per month, and I maintain it. So if anything goes down or whatever, which it normally, I really have not had that much issue with any services going down. I kind of keep an eye on some of the stuff whenever I get a chance. And of course they do too. And just bill them. And that's actually a good thing to have going on, because you can kind of mark that stuff up a lot more, and it's worth it to them, you know, because they don't have to worry about it. And as long as you're not trying to like rip them off or anything, you're kind of offering a service. You know, if it, for me, if it takes me like an hour every month to kind of just, you know, get online and make sure everything is still A-okay, you know, I'll charge them maybe a couple hundred dollars extra a month on top of whatever the services are charging. So it's actually a pretty good residual income if you can kind of get that type of stuff and you're okay with, you know, with that type of headache, I guess. Of course, back everything up.
So how do you structure it? So I've had both scenarios that I've done. I have created, so say that let's give a tangible example. Say you've got an API that you've built, and then you have a React Native app, since we're on React Native podcast. You have that app, that API deployed to, let's just say Heroku. And do you create separate accounts for like separate email addresses, password? Do you keep things separate, or do you lump them all into your, say you've got, you know, one or two accounts that you keep with Heroku or AWS or whoever? How do you go about breaking that down?
I actually keep them all on one account. So I have my account, and depending on the company or whatever the service is, sometimes they'll let you structure it to where you can kind of have the projects listed out, or sometimes they're just all kind of bunched in there. And as long as the project or the, I guess as long as the API or whatever the service is manageable for me to do that, I usually do that. So
got it. Have you ever run into a situation where that didn't work?
Not particularly. No. I usually just get everything set up for the development, just get it working. For the most part, they have so much going on, or they're not tech savvy enough to where they even care. But normally once it's all set up and everything's working and they're happy with it, they don't really want to deal with the transition, or they'll say, oh, we'll do that another time. And they just don't get around to doing it.
I split everything up. One, like the simplest reason is like the perks of referral codes, right? So for any new client I have, they get a new vault and one password, and I just store all their passwords in that. And then I always set up my personal account as like the referral. So I've got like a million DigitalOcean and Cloudinary and I've got credits for everything, really. And I'm pretty transparent. I'm like, hey, listen, this is going to cost you $5 a month. I'm going to get you three different droplets and load balance or whatever, and I'm going to charge you a maintenance fee per month. And that's it. You know, I was like, it's just like a car, right? Like, you don't have to pay me a maintenance fee, but then you can't come to me if things aren't working out. Or if things aren't working out, I'm going to charge you a lot more than, you know, what I would charge you monthly for the upkeep. And that usually, they're usually just like, screw it. Like, I'll just pay you. Just take care of whatever you need to take care of.
Yeah, but that model too also makes it to where if they want it back at some point, you just hand it off, right? You just hand them the passwords and everything's already decoupled. So
sometimes I play like the CTO for companies too, and then like I always set them up with one password or whatever, and then when they do want something, they don't go to their Microsoft Word file with their passwords anymore. They go through one password, and so when it comes to like transferring over the vaults, it's super easy. So I've always liked to just like containerize everything, just so it kind of lives in its own ecosystem, generating different passwords prevents any, you know, prevents the risk of any malicious attack that could take place and stuff. So I used to run everything, like I started running everything off of like one big Linux server, you know, before I knew about DigitalOcean and stuff. And that was like convenient, but then the server went down once and it meant like five other sites went down too and people weren't too happy. So that's kind of when I smartened up a bit, started charging them a little more and gave myself the freedom to host everything on their own accounts, as inconvenient as that may be sometimes.
Yeah, I've done the same. I started off that hosting business. I had all the accounts on one server, and it was very cost effective. But then, like you said, when things went down, things went down. And this was before the days of like really easy backups and all the nice stuff that we have right now. But then I've started to kind of diversify and then even offload to third party services. Like I said, with this baseball bat company, I just said, look, what's the platform that has the PCI compliance, the stuff I don't have to worry about, and will allow me to interact with the templating system with my editor of choice. And so I don't have to be in this WYSIWYG in a browser. And Shopify kind of grew themselves, I think, out of the just giving developers the hooks they need into it and being able to kind of turnkey, you know, or build a really custom shopping cart, you know, with the tools that they're used to. So, you know, that part I just don't have to worry about, right? I mean, I've done that to where I hosted e-commerce sites on a box with 75 other sites when I was late teens, early 20s. And then the thing went down or a certificate expired or something like that. And I don't know, just kind of offloading to third-party services or compartmentalizing those, or just saying, hey, I'll hit your endpoints to get the data I need, and I'll make it available on this thing, and you can get, you know, I don't know, just kind of using those services and to your advantage. But I mean, I am in the situation with two projects that I think of it matter that they just want someone to do it. They have no idea what it is, and they're just like, we just want this thing to work, and it's a couple of little databases, but. You know, and so I have them on one box, and, you know, there is nothing to offload, right? I mean, it's either me, when I can't maintain it, then it doesn't exist anymore to them. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know. Sometimes those projects are acceptable. So,
depends on the project, I guess. I mean, if the customer is someone that, you know, is going to want everything, I would definitely recommend doing that, you know, having it separate. But if it's not, then I guess it's really up to the person, what their workflow is like, and just, you know, what their view of that type of stuff is.
Yeah, certainly.
Lee, did you have a question?
I don't do a lot of freelancing because I have a lot of responsibility in the job I have now and previous jobs. So I work a lot, and just the time it takes away from my family. You know, I work a lot and I have a wife, three kids. It's just never worth it to me. Whatever the billing hour is, it's just never worth it. So I guess my real question would be, like, for you, Peter, how did you transition into doing it for full time?
So like, that's like something I've been thinking about too. Like right now I have the free time, you know, and the opportunities to do all those things. But I'm just sort of like wondering if consulting is exactly what I want to be doing during this free time right now. The only reason I did quit my job and did start consulting is to save up some money and work on my own product. But I'm finding myself doing much more consulting than actually, you know, building my own product. And I don't have I don't think I've got that much time left when it comes to just like the freedom to do whatever I want, right? Like I'm still, you know, young and I don't have children yet, but you know, that'll probably change over the next few years. So I've really been like contemplating, like, what do I want to do? You know, like, is it really worth the money? Right? Like, if there's any time for me to build anything, now's the time, because I know I won't be able to later on in life.
You know, that's definitely a big thing, because I do a little too much, I feel like. And I normally end up really having to budget every minute of my life because of that. And I feel like if I didn't have so much going on, like freelancing and stuff, that my life would be a lot simpler and I would be able to spend a lot more time with my family. But I think there is a way to kind of have all of that. If you can kind of like, you know, just set aside those hours, be it sometimes I'll get up early in the morning. So if I have to be at work at 8, sometimes maybe setting aside an hour and a half every morning for 5 days will give me those hours for the entire month. And it's one of those things that if you kind of do it consistently and you have a set time and you don't spend that hour and a half like browsing Reddit or doing your email and stuff, you just kind of open your computer, do the work, you know, log the hours, you can kind of fit it in there. But at the same time, you know, it's really up to the person. If you have a ton of responsibility at your job, or if you're making enough money to feel comfortable, and you know, whether or not you feel like you even feel like it's a benefit to kind of do this, you know, it really kind of, I guess, depends on the person and where they are in their career and their, in their life.
Yeah, Peter, I was going to say also, I see the side that what you're kind of struggling with. I did that, like, you know, like I wanted to start a company and I had a lot, like I look back now and I had a lot of years that I could have, you know, built any number of products. And I did go through those things. Like while I had a full-time job, I, you know, did that whole evaluating my product idea and it turns out it wasn't anything good. So, you know, I mean, obviously. But then, you know, and I thought, oh man, you know, I've got to do it before I have kids because I'll never. And actually I've been able to, and this is just me, I'm not saying, I'm just offering it as discussion. Like, but you know, my perspective is changed after kids. Like I'm actually a little bit more, you know, focused when I have that time. And so I view if I want to build a product, and there's actually something I've been working on for a couple of years and I picked it up and put it down and it's actually proven its usefulness to me when it comes up in conversation. So I'm kind of iterating on it to have something to show because it seems to be a value. And I don't think it's going to be something that's going to make millions of dollars, but it may be something that just satisfies, like, you know, there's a common analogy that you don't always have to be like the best Italian restaurant in the face of the earth to be successful. You just have to be the Italian restaurant that's in the neighborhood because the people in the neighborhood are going to go to that Italian restaurant because it's there, you know, and like that's a huge success. And so if you have a small niche of customers that benefit from whatever utility you're able to build, then that's great, you know. And so that may be where this falls. And it may just be an open source kind of thing, but I've taken that project and I've kind of made it my freelance. So I didn't take on any, like obviously when we found out we were pregnant, late or in the, I guess it would have been August, last year, I didn't take on any additional, you know, I had finished up something and I didn't take anything else on. So that became like something that I could work on. So I'm saying that to say it's worth noting that your freelancing could be your idea, whatever your idea is that you want to iterate on, you know, build on while you're working at whatever place you are. So
that's a really good point. I'm glad that you brought that up too. So thank you.
But also on the flip side, I have a stable job. So, I mean, on the flip side, I know that sometimes I work better under pressure. And so if I were like, okay, you know, I really think that, I don't know, let's say I have 80 hours that would deliver this project. You know, I could, if I were in a, you know, that would be like 2 weeks from now if I didn't have income coming in, you know. And so on the flip side, while you may have a lot of time to implement your idea and think about it, I know that a lot of the I've got a lot of projects that I've started and that are still sitting on my laptop in various, like if you were to look at the directory structure, you could see like 84%, 65%, 32%, like various stages of completion throughout the years, you know. And it's like, it was a good idea, but whatever reason I froze at like 84%, you know, I was almost there, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't know that there is the whole flip side to like, I understand exactly where you're at and like, okay, well, and I think this may be where you are. And like, okay, well, I'm never going to like be serious about my product, my, product until I don't have anything to focus on but it. So if I, quit my job and if I'm able to focus on it and fill in with consulting, then, I'm going to see it through.
So this has been a really good talk. I think we're going to have to we've already gone over a little bit, but I think we're going to have to kind of continue this on a future episode. Maybe we'll do a episode 2, episode 3 of this discussion and kind of keep it going. But I think we're going to go ahead and get to the picks. But before we do, I just want to throw out there, this is a React Native and React podcast. And as far as consulting and freelancing goes, for the most part, the clients I've dealt with don't care about the tech stack, which is a good thing for me because I can kind of pick the right tool and I can kind of experiment with new things sometimes. But I would say don't get stuck on one thing. If you feel like using Cordova or something to build a mobile app would be better for a certain thing, use that. Or if you're familiar with Angular and you can do a list app faster, more efficiently, I would just say shoot for whatever you want to do. I wouldn't get too stuck on React or React Native. But of course, if you're doing web right now, React is definitely a good option. And I'm using React Native right now for a project, and I'm having a very good experience with it. So I just wanted to, point that out since we haven't really discussed that. So let's go ahead and get into the picks. My picks are going to be, the first one is a talk from Ching Liu on the spectrum of abstraction at React Europe. It was my favorite talk from the conference. And all of the talks, I believe, are either on YouTube or they're going to be on YouTube by the time this podcast is released. My second pick is going to be the Freelancer Show on devchat.tv. If you're a developer, this may not sound like the type of show you would want to listen to, but they have over 200 episodes, and I've found quite a few of them to be very, very beneficial to me on my career, being able to build people. And a lot of the stuff we've talked about, they go into a lot of depth about that. They go into a lot of depth about marketing as yourself as well. So I would definitely recommend checking those episodes out. Lee, do you have any picks?
Yeah, and I can't remember if we've discussed this on one of our calls or not, but the pepperoni. Have we talked about pepperoni yet?
No.
Yeah, because I know we had discussed it offline with a few groups, but and we've had Alex on the show, but the pepperoni, getpepperoni.com by the Futurist guys, is basically a boilerplate, but it's more so than just React Native. You get all zero, you get deployment scripts for AWS, you get code push, you get push notifications, you get Redux, a node backend, like everything you would need to build a app from scratch, front to back, including deployment and everything. So it's a really cool take and one of the first times we've seen this in the React Native world. And I definitely hope that it gets some ground and we see some alternatives and all that.
Awesome. Has anyone played around with Pepperoni yet?
No, not yet.
Yeah, and it was Andre Stoltz. We've had him on in the past, and he's one of the contributors there at Futurist.
Cool. Hopefully I'll be able to download it this next week or two and have some more to contribute about that, because it does look like a really cool project. Kevin, do you have any picks?
Yes, I've got two picks. One is a Medium post about the Discourse API in GraphQL. Discourse is a forum software that's implemented in Ruby on Rails. So it's an open source project on GitHub. And it's actually a rather large open source project. So they even have it to where you can spin up. They've got a Docker file that you could spin up your Discourse instance in a container. And they were actually one of the first that I heard about a couple of years ago that were doing that. There is either a Ruby Rogues episode or Software Engineering Daily, one of those that talks to the people, the Discourse guys. I'll try to dig that up and put it in the show notes. But anyway, this post is from the Apollo stack, and the Apollo stack's I'm not really sure how to describe it yet. The only part that I've looked at is the Apollo client, which I found in the discussions in a Redux GitHub issue with Dan Abramov and other contributors of how to use Redux with GraphQL. Anyway, this post talks about GraphQL, and it actually implements a wrapper that talks to Discourse. the Rails application. And what's impressive is they replace the 600 routes that the Discourse API has with GraphQL and the, you know, strong typing that GraphQL offers. And so it's a pretty interesting read, you know, just in like a real world use case of why and how and what are the benefits you would get from using GraphQL as your solution. So I'll put that in the show notes. I want to mention BrowserSync. So my pick is not actually BrowserSync, but there is a repo in the BrowserSync user on GitHub. It's just called recipes. So it's github.com BrowserSync recipes. And inside of that recipe, there are any number of configurations of using BrowserSync with Webpack, with Browserify, etc. And one that I've actually really fallen in love with is the ability to use BrowserSync with the hot module reloading that I'm used to. So I, in my React web applications, use Webpack and hot module reloading with a, I was using Webpack dev server, but I wanted to use the newer Webpack dev middleware and hot middleware. And so I rolled it together with just a custom Express server, which is really trivial. It's actually in, Dan Abramov has a React hot loading boilerplate. I'm not sure if that's exactly the thing, but it's, if that's the name of the project, but it's on, it's in github.com/gearon, which is his username. But what's neat about this, this project, this recipe that they have for hot module reloading in BrowserSync is that you get the benefits of hot module reloading for your React based stuff. And then you get BrowserSync to manage the injection of CSS if you don't want your CSS managed by Webpack. And I've actually found that like the, you know, like it, it essentially gives you the hot module or hot CSS reloading. So, and then if it doesn't match one of those two things, it will refresh the page. So it's basically a recipe. It's basically a recipe to, in my opinion, be the trifecta that I've been looking for a long time, because BrowserSync is absolutely amazing, but I don't want to refresh the page because I've got state that I want to keep there. So in my React stuff, I want to inject the via the hot module reloading that I've got set up with Webpack, and vice versa. A lot of times I'll use just straight CSS with the day-to-day day job, because that is handled with Rails. And so I'm literally just I may be modifying one file, but in production, you know, it's not, I just need on the fly kind of CSS tweak. So I really don't have a need for like a Webpack build of the CSS in that particular project. So what's neat is that it would, BrowserSync would, via its socket, it would inject the diff for the CSS, and it just creates this amazing developer experience that I've kind of been searching for. It, you know, I wanted to get BrowserSync in the mix for a while, and I kind of stumbled upon this. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Definitely give it a try. I'm actually, the only thing, one thing that I'm working on that I'll probably have sent in as a PR is that it's still using Babel 5 on that particular project. But in one of mine, when I was testing around with it, I'd upgraded it to Babel 6 and those plugins. So that should be there when you see this, or when you hear this episode.
Nice. So it's something that you can just, is it a project you can kind of download and use as a starter project?
Yes. Yes. Awesome. It's actually a fully working little React app that's got your package JSON in it, that's got all the modules. Like it's actually, it's really, really nice. And there are others. There's, I don't know, there's probably 15 different variations of using BrowserSync with some other utility, but there are several of them that are with the React hot loading and things. But this is, I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's actually very impressive that as a community, we were able to get all three of these tools kind of working together. So that's my pick.
Okay, cool. Peter, do you have any picks?
Yeah, so my pick is Andrew Clark's Recomposing Your React Application. I've been a huge fan of Recompose, and I've been using stateless function components for a while now. His library has been super helpful, and he's got a fantastic talk that can guide you through it.
Awesome. All right. Well, I guess that wraps up our episode. So this has been episode 30 of React Native Radio. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.